This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, and even an online store with the Squarespace Commerce feature. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TREK6. And also by TrekFan. TrekFan isn't just a Star Trek fan club, it's a challenge. You'll explore new places, learn new things, and collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles, complete real-life mission objectives, and win great prizes. To face your first challenge and find out more, head on over to TrekFan.org.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today, as he is every week, is my co-host, Matthew Rushing. But, Matthew, something's going on. I think maybe the wormhole is undergoing an inversion, because I see a third person in the room with us today.
Oh, you know what? Don't mind him. I'm just dragging him through time as an anchor. So, yeah, he just happens to pop in every once in a while. It's usually at the most inconvenient times, like, you know, when I'm podcasting or taking a shower or trying to sleep. He always wants to talk, too, so it's real obnoxious.
But he really does. Well, you know, he looks a lot like friend of the network and a professor from College of Lake County in Illinois, John Tenuto. John, is that you with us today?
It is, but let's not waste time. We only have a few seconds. Tell me what's happened.
Right, you could vanish at any moment.
Okay, well, let's see. We have the first black president. His name's Obama. Star Trek Into Darkness came out. It's a lot like another Star Trek movie you've seen.
Oh, I'm going away already. Bye.
Oh, crap.
You gotta hurry.
That's my horrible Cisco invasion.
That's your Cisco. Oh, my goodness.
I don't like you, and I don't like your hat. Yes, it's me. Thanks. Hi, guys.
Chris does a really good Kira, so, you know, hopefully one day.
There's your wormhole!
Oh, goodness.
Sounds just like her, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, John is joining us today to talk about one of our favorite Deep Space Nine episodes and a favorite of many fans, The Visitor. So, John, when we talked about doing The Visitor on the show here, we knew that we wanted to have you join us. And why don't you tell us, you know, your thoughts about The Visitor, how it made an impression on you, why it's one of your favorite episodes?
Well, I love that. I mean, I think it's the best episode of any Star Trek, and that's saying a lot because there's so many great episodes. But I think it's an important television episode period in the history of television, because, you know, you don't see a lot of stories about fathers and sons, at least not then. It's becoming more common now, but back then there wasn't a lot of that, and there's certainly not on TV, and certainly not about single fathers with their kid, and just all of the kind of cultural layering with that. I mean, I think just in terms of television history, it's an important episode, but I also think that it's just, to me, it's my favorite Star Trek episode. I watch it differently every time I watch it, depending on what's going on in my life. When I first watched it, I watched it as a son and responded that way. I've watched it many times since then, but, you know, when you become a father, you watch it differently, and I just recently lost my dad in March, and I watched it again you know, to prepare for our talk, and it plays differently. And I think that is the mark of just a great piece of entertainment.
Yeah, and I have the same experience as you. You know, I watched it when I was in university, and then later I became a father. You know, now I have two children. And then I also lost my father last year. So watching it again now, it's yet another view that I have of that story and the emotion that's going on there, especially with Jake.
Yeah. I remember I showed it when it first aired. I just happened to be teaching a class on death and dying, of all topics, a real happy class, but called The Sociology of Death and Dying. And it just happened by the way the class was and the time of day it was that I'd say 80%, 90% of my students were just these big, giant football player guys who were in between practices, you know, and they all took a class together. And I showed this episode, and they kind of were humming and, you know, groaning and, oh, the Tenuto of Star Trek, you know. There wasn't a dry eye in that classroom, and a lot of those guys really understood what that episode was about. And I always remember that day showing it to them. It had only been on like a couple of days before I showed it to them, and it was just so new and raw for me. But for them, it was, I think, just a really great experience for them, because a lot of them have that kind of situation with either absent fathers or you know, they were late. They were in that phase of life when they were kind of resisting their dad a little bit or whatever. It was a great moment.
For me, it's interesting because, you know, the first time I saw this episode, I was younger, and my parents were together, and now watching it, it's different because my parents aren't together anymore, and it does create a much different viewing experience now that, you know, there's been a change in my life and reflection of parents. And watching it again tonight actually was one of those times where it gets you with the feels. It just gives you the feels, and it's not something that every episode can do. And I think, you know, John, you're right. The importance, I think, even more so now than when it was on, of talking about fathers and what they do for their children and the importance of having them in their lives is something that we see over and over again in our society now, really, really struggling with people losing that. And we're seeing the repercussions of it with really firsthand the lack of fatherhood in so many children's lives, especially young boys. And seeing them not understand what it means to become a man, because, you know, manhood really is—it's not something you can just learn. You know, it's really something that's passed on. And when sons don't have a good father figure in their life to teach them what it means to be a really good man, there's something that's lost. And you really see that in this episode. You know, Jake struggling with the fact that there's nobody there to really continue his growth and push him into manhood. And obviously, you know, Sisko and Jake have such a strong relationship in the first place.
And of course, in this situation, it's amplified for Jake by the fact that his mother is gone as well. So he realizes that he's left with no one at this point.
Right. I mean, you know, he can go back and be with his grandfather, but there's just something about the relationship, I think, that they built on the show between Jake and Ben that was really unique. And you know, again, John, I think you're completely right. I don't know if there's ever been as good of a relationship between a son and a father in any show that I can think of, that really portrayed what it meant to be a father who really loved your son and was pouring into your son, being supportive of your son, helping grow him.
And to kiss him, to kiss him, and to, you know what I mean? That just that affection.
Right.
We were at the Star Trek convention last week in Rosemont, and Ciroc Lofton spoke, and then maybe about an hour later, Avery Brooks spoke. And I got to tell you, it wasn't a flashy talk. It wasn't hilarious like, you know, Brent Spiner and Jonathan Frakes. But Ciroc Lofton, I've never been as impressed with a young man in my life as I was with him, certainly on stage, and how one of the things he talked about and Avery Brooks talked about, they really are father and son. I mean, they really have that kind of relationship with one another, and it's genuine, and it's not like just like an occasional thing. It's an everyday part of their lives, and he needed that at that time. So, I mean, I think what we were seeing on screen wasn't as much acting as it was a really genuine, you know, love affair between two people that fathers and sons have with each other.
Well, and it's the beauty of that last scene where, you know, Cisco has driven Jake out of the way, you know, they're both safe, and yet Cisco's left with everything that's happened remembering, and, right. and Jake hasn't. And the feeling that he has knowing that his son's life was kind of broken without him, and the importance that he's going to play in his son's life, it's a big deal to see that, and it's something that just, again, I think doesn't get stressed enough to men, what they're going to mean to their sons, what they're going to mean to their daughters when they have children. And you know, it's not something to be taken lightly. And I love that Deep Space Nine and Ben and Jake really show the importance of what it means to be a parent to a child. It's probably, again, I think it's one of the best relationships between any child and parents that's been seen on TV, whether it's, you know, a single parent or a two parent family. You know, what a beautiful representation of somebody taking on that mantle and not being afraid to put their child first.
I was thinking about how, you know, everybody has different truths about how they define what it means to be a father or a son. But, you know, for me, I think a good father wants their son, maybe the only man in the world, that they want their son when they grow up to become a man, to be better than they are. I think, you know, I don't have that feeling towards I want my friends to necessarily be better than I am, or my coworkers to be better than I am, but you've done your job as a father. I would also believe as a mother, but, you know, speaking from my own experience, you've done your job as a father when your son is a better man than you are. And I think then a flip side of that is the idea that a son eventually, not right away, but eventually, really takes stock of their own life in a way based on what their father built. You know, what is the legacy of their father? And the son always measures himself against the father, but I think we do it in a very different way when we're adults ourselves. And I think this episode hit at both of those ideas in a way that I've never seen any other show really do in a truly, I mean, talk about realistic, right? I mean, it's such a genuine, realistic expression of a human experience, I think, between those two characters. And then that dynamic of the son, you know, the father being proud that his son is, you know, not just doing good, but doing better than, you know, than he did. Mm-hmm. And then the son not wanting to leave because his father built that place. When Jake Sisko says that when he's talking with Kira, and he says, I don't want to leave. This is my home. This is a place my father built. That just rips your guts out when he says that. So it's a really wonderful, presentation. You know, the science fiction of it doesn't matter as much as the real emotion that's there.
That's the thing with this episode. Yeah, you have this sci-fi element. You have this tech element of the wormhole and its inversion. But it's also tied in a way to what I find interesting about it is that, you know, we know that subatomic particles are somehow intertwined. You know, they can be many, many light years, even across the galaxy from each other, but yet somehow they can affect one another. And it's sort of like that here with Jake and with Benjamin, that they are tied in that way somehow. Something's tugging them back and forth. And so it has that great little science slash sci-fi element in there for Star Trek. But at the same time, like you said, the sci-fi really doesn't matter that much here, that you can rip all the Star Trek out of this and you can rip all that tech out of this. And it still stands up as such an incredible story that it really transcends Star Trek. It's one of the very few stories that transcends Star Trek just because of this human element that we're talking about. And I think that's why, John, you said that for you, it's maybe the greatest Star Trek episode of all the series. And, you know, likewise for me, it's definitely in my top, you know, 10 episodes, which is saying a lot. We're talking about over 700 episodes because it's one of those stories like The Inner Light is in TNG, where you can just rip the Star Trek out of it and you still have this amazing story.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying about the subatomic particles, they, I mean, that is what we do, isn't that? I mean, we do drag our fathers through our lives in a way, where when they're gone, especially. Yeah. That they are this anchor in a way for us that we are connected to, and that we continue to measure ourselves against, especially when they're gone, whether they're gone because they're dead or gone because they're not there, or, you know, or because we've moved away or whatever. But our parents are always, we're sort of always rubber banded to them. And I think that theme is great. And then to do it with the science fiction side of it, is that little Star Trek twist.
Yeah. It's a really neat, thing to see that, and I was reading on it was Memory Alpha, and they were talking about what Stephen Ira Barrett said about the episode, and he really liked that, you know, a lot of times in stories and on TV and shows, you do something about romantic love. But they really liked that this dealt with, you know, just a father-son relationship, familial love, because that helps it transcend and make it relevant for everyone. So even if you're somebody who is not a son or a father, you know, you're a daughter, you're a mother, so you understand all of these feelings that are happening in this episode, and so anybody watching it can immediately relate somehow, even if, you know, say you had a horrible father. Well, this episode digs in just to how much you were missing, you know, and all of that. And so I think that's one of the things that, like you said, John, this is what makes this not only just a great Star Trek episode, but it makes it a great episode of television in the first place, because it's something that just about anybody can watch and completely relate to, the emotion that's happening, the story that's happening, and the desire, even if you don't have this relationship, by the end of this episode, you're feeling something pretty big because you wish you had this. That's power right there in storytelling.
Well, let's move on and talk about the acting a little bit, because another thing that makes this episode work is Tony Todd as the elder Jake Sisko. And likewise, I would say that this is one of Cirroc Lofton's best performances, if not his best performance on Deep Space Nine as well.
Yeah, I mean, hands down, I was watching the episode tonight, and I want it to just be really fresh. And obviously, I've seen it 100 zillion times, because, like John, this is one of my favorites of all time. And I was really struck by, I feel like every single person in the cast was upping their game. It's like they knew how good this episode was, and they weren't just doing the normal thing. They were doing the best they could. And Cirroc really, you could feel the emotion of the minute, you know, Ben disappears into the Defiant's room, him kind of moping around at the station. And actually, probably my favorite scene is the one between him and Anna in the upper pylon. And it's just that beautiful scene. It's very little light, but the emotion between those two actually really sets up well what the end of the series is going to be, because it's pretty much the same shot, except from the outside of the window. It's just beautiful because you buy it, you know. There's never a moment where you don't think this is really a boy who's dealing with the loss of the most important person in his life.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't a bad moment in the episode. I don't think, in terms of acting, what Matt had mentioned, that moment between Nanan and Sirik, when they're everything in that, the music, the light, the lighting is insanely fantastic. Their acting is just really great. Every time I watch it, there's something new, or I think of something new. I was thinking of how when the very first thing you see in the episode is, you know, it's a dark and stormy night outside, right? And it starts with this dark and stormy night. And I was thinking that's the cliche, right? That's from Paul Clifford, you know, from 1830. It starts off with that line, and it's a dark and stormy night. And everybody uses that book as that, how you're not supposed to write. You know, bad writers use that kind of description. And I thought, what a great, you know, here it's about Jake and he's a writer, and it opens with it's a dark and stormy night. And, you know, all of that, just little things like that that you pick up. And then, but I think the very first time I watched it, the one thing I noticed was how amazing the acting was. It didn't take repeated viewings to see that. And that end moment that Matt said, that last line of Sisko, where he says, you know, I'm okay now, or it's okay now, it's just, the acting is so incredibly good on both of their parts in that moment. And, you know, that this didn't receive the kind of accolades it should have, that's really a sin.
Yeah, and Tony Todd is, the nuance in his performance here is quite amazing. You know, we've seen him prior to this in Star Trek as Kern, the Klingon. And what you see here is there are moments where he really captures Sirik Lofton's reactions or even tone of voice. There are moments where he captures, it's like he captures Avery Brooks through Sirik Lofton. He says something the way that you could picture, this is an older Jake Sisko who speaks this way because of the influence of his father, Benjamin. You know, if you look at your own children and some of the things that they say, and you can see yourself in that, and you know that they do it because they've learned it just from watching you. And for another actor, for Tony Todd, to be able to capture that, like two levels down, it amazed me, that the performance in this episode.
Well, and I think for me, the thing that I was really shocked by in this episode, you know, the first time you saw it, it was kind of jarring because you have no really idea what's going on. And it's Tony Todd, and I obviously recognize him from other Star Trek work. And then this young girl comes in, and immediately I'm just kind of swept away in what's happening. I don't really care that I don't know what's going on, because they're giving such, you know, earnest and beautiful, comfortable performances, you know. And I really like Rachel Robinson's performance in this episode. You know, obviously she got a lot from her dad, Andrew Robinson, Garrick, and you can see that in her performance. It comes off so natural and real to me when I'm watching it. And I love that it's also a story about somebody searching out one of their heroes and their idols and actually getting a real honest, you know, story from them about their life, you know, really telling them what it was like. And I think that's a cool part of this story that doesn't have anything to do with the Jake and the Ben part, you know, that's another great story in and of itself. And so there's these two great things happening in this episode, and I like those layers because I don't feel like I'm being pulled out every time they come back to reality, because I'm enjoying that story as well.
Yeah, you get the theme of the old Jake, right? He's helping two young people in this episode, right? He's helping this young girl. And, you know, and her, and the nice thing about this episode is there's no reason that her future isn't exactly what we saw. So it's not like she's wiped out. Jake is going to write, and maybe he'll write more. But he's going to write those things that we know that he wrote, and she's going to become a fan of his work, and she could still go visit him when he's old, you know? And so that it's not like a reset button at the end of this episode. Sisko has a memory of what happened. You know, Captain Sisko, you know, this girl will still be there. She will most likely still be a fan. You know, and all those things, that there are permutations of what will still happen. And so that theme that you're this old man and he's sort of helping, he's helping his younger father, he's helping his young self, and he's helping this young lady. And it's kind of a neat counterpoint. And I think the acting sells a lot of it, because everyone who plays old in this does a really good job, because if they didn't, it really would have affected the episode negatively. But, you know, they all carried, you know, whether it was Terry Farrell, and I was actually appreciating Alexander Siddig's sort of version of his older self in this, that he played it in a pretty interesting way, considering especially that we will know later that he's genetically enhanced. But, you know, nobody plays it where you look at it and you go, you know, I don't believe that they've aged. They slump their shoulders. They walk slower. They change their body positions. So there's a lot of acting, you know, with the body as well as with the voice and face. And they really had to use all their muscles as an actor with this episode, which means it was well written.
Yeah, and even Nog captures that feeling. He still has that enthusiasm that you expect from Nog, but as he advances in rank and age, you know, the pitch of his voice comes down. He has more confidence in the way that he speaks, but it's still Nog all the way. And that one was interesting to me as well, how to capture Nog as he advanced, because with the other characters, they're already older. I mean, they're already adults in the present time of DS9, and then they're aging and they're getting older. But here you have someone who's actually a kid at the start of the series and is just now, you know, a teenager at this point in season four. But towards the end, he has become a captain of a starship. So I thought Aaron Eisenberg had quite an acting feat to do there to make that believable.
Well, and it's really interesting to see that Nog is a captain and Dax is still a commander, and Bashir is still, like, I think, a lieutenant commander. So they really haven't, you know, gone very far in rank. But Nog, man, that boy's up there. He's running starships. You know,
he's a real go-getter at the academy.
Yeah, they know one of the important lessons Star Trek teaches us, which is don't accept promotions, right? That's the
right.
I actually tell my students that. I mean, I really think that's a great piece of advice. That we, you know, there's an idea in sociology called the Peter Principle, which is people tend to be promoted to their own level of incompetence, and that's what happens. You do a great job, so what do? They promote you out of the job you're doing good into another job, and you keep getting promoted till a certain level when you don't get a promotion anymore, which presumes you're not doing a good job anymore. And so I always loved in Generation when Kirk's like, don't let them promote you. So I always think, like, people who don't take promotions, they're good at what they do.
Yeah, I know there was that encounter that we never got to see on screen where Dr. Bashir met Dr. McCoy, and McCoy told him, don't ever let them promote you. Don't ever let them make you a full commander.
Right.
They'll take you out of that sick bay. going back to Tony Todd, one thing I did want to point out too about how diverse he is as an actor. Just 12 episodes after this, we get Sons of Moog, where he comes back as Kern. So in the same, not only in the same season, but in the same half of the same season, you have Tony Todd playing the elder Jake in this episode, and then you have him playing Kern, the Klingon, again. And of course, if you're a Star Trek fan and you're really, really familiar, yes, you're going to know it's Tony Todd. But if you just think like average viewer watching and how different the portrayal of character is in such a short time period, it's quite amazing.
Yeah, he is a wonderful actor.
It is really good to see him. And, you know, just a quick thing, as I love that when they're in the engine room in the Defiant, it's in that kind of alternate timeline now, and you can tell by the uniforms and everything. The banter between Dax and Bashir is hilarious, and you can tell that they are still the best of friends, even though it seems from the dialogue that Bashir's gone off, got married, you know, he talks about his grandkids all the time, and he's always pestering Dax, you know, the same way he always has been. And so I just really like that they're able to kind of drop these little hints of what these people's lives are like then. And it's pretty interesting. I actually kind of want to know more about what that timeline was like for the other characters, because it sounds, you know, just very interesting. And that's, I think, a good writing thing as well, where you feel like, I want to know more about that, but, you know, you obviously can't do that in this story. And so that's just a great story point to be able to add on top of everything else.
Definitely. So in addition to the acting, another thing that makes this episode really work is the music. And it's shocking to me that this episode was not nominated for any awards for music, because the Suite from The Visitor is just one of the most moving compositions that was created for Star Trek in general. But, you know, imagine this episode without that music, just with some, I don't know, recycled music from other episodes. It would have lost a lot of the... It powers through the emotion and the acting. It enhances it in a way that was very, very deserving of recognition.
It's one of the things that I noticed on the rewatch that I did tonight, just the fact that just immediately the episode starts with the music, and it draws you in, and it really tells you right off the bat that this is going to be a completely different episode than you've seen before. You know, we're going to do something very different here. We're not going to do what we do every week, so just stay with us. And I really like that the music helps bring that out immediately, I think. And then the themes that are created weave throughout the episode, and it's really wonderful in the way that, you know, the greatest, say, you know, John Williams scores are really wonderful, and the greatest Star Trek scores are really wonderful, and they just kind of bring you along for the ride.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I really think it's Dennis McCarthy's best, you know, I mean, he does the theme to Deep Space Nine itself, which is a beautiful theme,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, this, what Matt said is absolutely so true, that the music is given a chance. There are moments of quiet in this episode that you normally don't get in Star Trek, and it allows the music to really take center stage from the start, but also throughout the whole episode. And it's not, you know, a lot of times the Star Trek music is almost incidental music in a way, where it there is no tonality to it.
Right.
And then the really great scores are the ones that have that, you know, where they sort of allow the composer to open up a little bit and give us some melodies and themes. And this one's like really very much like a traditional score. And I also think, you know, I always remember what John Williams said about episode 3, that one of the most effective juxtapositions you could have is to have something horrific or horrible happening on screen, and then you have beautiful music over it, which is why when the Jedi are all being killed, if this spoils the film for anybody, sorry, but you should have seen it better. But when all the Jedi are killed, you have this beautiful music playing, you know, which is just, it's odd, but it makes it much more affecting. And I think that this is, in this episode, it isn't that you're seeing horrific things in a violent way, but you're seeing this sacrifice by the son for the father. And I think that, and it's a sacrifice that as a father you would feel would be horrific if your son did that. Mm. And then, but it's juxtaposed against this really beautiful sad music, and I think that that it becomes a character in the story this time.
Yeah, which I think I do wish that they had done sometimes more often in Star Trek, would have really allowed the artists to run with that, because I really think that it helps episodes. You know, thematic music really has a way of drawing us in and making us feel something or laugh more or all of those kind of things in a way that you just, you know, don't get otherwise. And I'm a big fan of more thematic music than that kind of atmospheric music that you get a lot in, modern scores. And right. Star Trek really did that in the TV shows a lot. And so, you know, their best episodes are the ones like this or, say, The Inner Light, where you really have some music that drives home what you're seeing.
Yeah, it was one thing that was great about the music from the original series was there were a lot of themes and a lot of motifs in the TOS scores. And then we moved into the Next Generation, and you talk about atmospheric music. You know, a lot of the early TNG stuff was very atmospheric, and it was very 80s. It was very electronic and kind of ethereal, synthesized sound. And then that progressed. But then when we get to DS9, I think we did get a lot more thematic music in DS9 than we had gotten through TNG, but still very few of them top what we got here. You know, this is a suite that you can just put on and listen to it as a piece of classical composition, completely separate from the fact that it was written to score an episode of television.
Mm.
Well, let's move on to a couple of other points about the episode. And one thing we wanted to talk about was this whole idea of phasing in and out, which we joked about at the beginning of the show. Unfortunately, John phased out before you could tell him very much about what was going on these days, Matthew, but now he's back with us. So before he leaves again, how do you guys feel about this phasing in and out as a plot device?
Well, I thought it was a good, how do you have him be dead and not be dead? You know, I mean, there's a certain, it was a way, I think, in no way does it feel like an Obi-Wan Kenobi kind of mystical, you know, which I think is important in Star Trek, that it doesn't have a mysticism to it. Although you could get away with a little bit of mysticism on Deep Space Nine because of the Bajoran, you know, religious motifs through the whole show. But I, you know, to use that device as a way to, in essence, have him be Obi-Wan Kenobi in a way, I thought was a great use of sort of science as opposed to, you know, the Force or some religious or spiritual way. What wasn't exploited, as Matt said, but that's okay because it would have been a different story then, and I don't want this to be a different story, so this isn't a criticism. But, you know, they didn't exploit the what-ifs of this, and maybe someday they will in some of the novels a little bit more or something like that, because this is just ripe for, you know, what if there was no Sisko? What would have happened to all these characters, to the planet Bajor? You know, what you know, when their savior's gone before he's supposed to be gone? You know, what are the permutations of that? So you get hints of that in this episode, like there's no Dominion War. I mean, it doesn't look like there is, the way that the dialogue reads. The Klingon experience lasts longer, and the Klingons are more successful. But there doesn't appear to be a Dominion War, because they talk about going in and sort of testing and seeing what the Dominion reaction would be to us going back. So since we sort of stopped going there, they seem to have left us alone. And I thought it'd be interesting if they had, you know, someone had picked up with this, and or they had done another sequel to it or something like that. Although I'm kind of glad they didn't, because, you know, I don't necessarily want them to touch this, you know, in any way.
Right.
It's too special. You know, you don't want a sequel to E.T. and you don't want a sequel to this. So, but I think that the phasing was a good strategy because it allowed them to get what they needed out of it, but not rely on a sort of mystical solution.
I think it worked also because of Sisko's role as the emissary, and because we had already seen him on a number of occasions go into the wormhole. We know that there's something about him that, I guess at this point, we don't really know about Sarah, but we do know that there is something about him. There's some connection between him and the prophets. They have pulled him into the wormhole before. So the idea that he could remain alive, that he could not age, because for him, time is not passing because of the nonlinear nature of the prophets, and that he could somehow enter back into phase with us and interact with the crew and with Jake temporarily and then phase back out. Because of the way the series is set up and the way the character is set up, it actually makes sense here. It doesn't feel like some convoluted transporter accident or something like that, that just gave some sort of magical properties to our characters temporarily, like we have seen on TNG before. In this case, it actually fit the character of Sisko in a very natural way.
Yeah, I really liked the way that they did this, because it gives you... I just accept it as what they're using to tell the story. And it never feels overly technobabbled. You know, they don't go into lots of it, but you did just enough so I feel that it makes the story possible. And what is really driving, obviously, is the drama of the father and the son, and I love that Star Trek and really sometimes, and most of the times, you know, our best science fiction is driven by science enough to tell an amazing dramatic story to show us something about ourselves. And that's just really what makes, I think, this one of the greatest Star Trek episodes ever, because, you know, at Star Trek's best, that's what it does. It uses science fiction to tell us a story about ourselves. And, you know, as we already talked about, this idea of fathers and this idea of sons and fatherhood is just as important now as it was then, if not more so. And this will, I don't think, ever not be an important story, you know. And so that's a really beautiful and really awesome thing to see. And the science of it, you know, it works enough to tell a really great story. I'm never drawn out of the story because of the technobabble. It only just enhances what's being told to me.
Most definitely. Yeah. Well, let's talk about a couple of other small items. We've already talked about the alternate timeline that is set up here quite a bit. I do think it would be very fascinating to find out what would have happened to everyone involved, not just our characters, yeah, but the Federation, the Klingons, the Cardassians, the Dominion, the entire Star Trek universe, just based on the fact that the death of Sisko, because he's such a pivotal character in the events that unfolded, you know, what it meant. I also found it interesting here, one thing we didn't mention is the fact that so soon after the end of this occupation of Bajor by the Cardassians, that the Bajorans actually enter into a defense pact with the Cardassians. And that's an unexpected twist given the history of those two worlds that that takes place largely because Sisko's gone. And you wouldn't think that one man would be that important. You can't, I mean, imagine any other captain in Starfleet. Can you think of any situation where the removal of one individual from a ship or a space station would have such an impact on the political churnings of what was going on?
No, I mean, I think that plays into the, you know, you never really know how much pre-planning there was. I don't know. They may have had a general idea, or they might have been more specific about where the show was eventually going to wind up and what was eventually going to happen with Sisko. But I think, you know, I think in some ways because he was such a revolutionary character, and I mean that in terms of, in a lot of ways, the sort of being the father character that he was, by being an African American captain on Star Trek. And frankly, I mean, I would have to look at that, what else was on at that time, but I don't think there was another drama on TV at that time. I could be wrong, of course, but that had your main character was an African American male with a son who he had to raise. I mean, there was a lot of that kind of cultural overlay. And I think, in some ways they needed to make the character, which says something about us, I think, at least at who we were, that they needed to make the character seem like more important. I also think it's because it was the third iteration. I mean, there's a lot of reasons. It isn't just things like race. It's also, it's the third iteration of Star Trek. How is this thing going to be different? I mean, there's all these dimensions there. And of course, it being seen in a way as a, you know, Deep Space Nine has always had that idea that it's the, sort of the least popular of the shows, even though it's generally considered to be, if not the best, one of the best versions of Star Trek, which is odd. You know, it was sort of lost there. You know, Next Gen, it was on when Next Gen was on. Next Gen was doing movies. They got all the attention. Then Voyager was on a network and DS9 was syndicated and all of that. And I think there was this idea of, like, let's have Sisko represent Star Trek. Let's have Sisko represent the show. And to make him that important, to the Bajoran people, to the history of the Federation, to the political machinations, was a way to say that Sisko matters, what Sisko represents matters, and that Sisko and all the Siskos, the real Siskos, that they matter, and that this is, I think it was, I don't know how much that was conscious or unconscious, but I like to think that they were thinking that way.
Plus, all of that setup strengthens this episode as well, because they're saying that Sisko's absence changes so much for the Bajorans, for the Federation. At the same time, his absence from Jake's life changes so much for Jake as well. So it's a really wonderful way that they were able to parallel the importance of him as a father to Jake and as a leader to Starfleet.
Yeah, it gives you to that wonderful idea that one person really can shape, you know, the future. And, you know, you think of, if you took, like, what if you had taken somebody like an Eisenhower out of World War II or MacArthur on the other side? What happens if that person's gone, you know? And, you know, so, and then two, we will later see, you know, how Sisko helps resolve the whole Klingon mess that's going on, and how much longer that goes on because he isn't there. So it's just it is really beautiful. And then on the other side, you are getting this idea as you watch the entire series that in some ways they really are hinting that Sisko is not just going to be important for this, you know, quadrant or anything, but he's going to be of utmost importance. Like, there's something special, different about him. And it's a great setup, and it's a, I don't know, I just really enjoy that aspect. And it's something that, you know, you have to be looking for, and that there's a lot of layers to this episode. And as you keep peeling it back, you keep finding more things. And again, it's just phenomenal writing.
Yeah, Michael Taylor deserves a lot of credit. I mean, he did this episode. He wrote In the Pale Moonlight, which is also another great episode, certainly, you know, a controversial episode where, you know, Sisko sides with the devil in a way and reconciles with that need to do that. And I thought, you know, he wrote some good Voyager episodes too. He wrote Counterpoint and Relativity, and so he's a great writer. But there's just something special about this episode, maybe because it is about something that's so universal, which is parents and children, and that resonate, and it just speaks a lot of truth. I think it's a good example of how, if you just write simply about truthful things, then and have a point of view, which this does. It's not afraid to say that fathers are important. Which, you know, Matt was talking about that. If you think back to when this episode aired, you know, hopefully not to be too controversial, but I think it's fair to say one of the things that emerged out of the feminist movement in the 70s and 80s was somehow this notion that fathers, maybe they weren't as important as mothers. You know, we did that in schools. We rightly focused a lot of attention on young girls because they had been ignored for so long, but we forgot the boys in that process. And I think what we start seeing around the time this episode is aired and more recently is the realization that we need to pay attention to little boys in school. We need to pay it. You know, fathers are important. All the data shows that. All of, you know, boys without fathers are more likely to be truant at school. They're more likely not to finish school. They're more likely to be a lower socioeconomic class than their parents were. I mean, all these years of lessons that we've learned, this episode is talking about that at a time when not a lot of other shows were. And that writing a truthful message, but one that was, in a way, a little ahead of its time, because I think the culture didn't come to that for another 5, 6, 7 years, where we started to realize, oh, maybe fathers are important, you know, just as important as mothers, and you know, maybe we need to pay attention to young boys and their relationships with their fathers a little more. And this show is talking about that, and then in that way, it truly is Star Trek, because it is speaking about social issues and being forward-thinking about it.
Right. Well, and two, you know, in that whole movement of this idea, you know, that genders, we want to kind of make them the same, you know, the men, women, we're not really all that different, but there really is something different between the effect that a father has on their children, and especially their sons, and that mothers do. And mothers can never completely replace their you know, the father figure in their son's life, and vice versa. So you really, these are things that are very, very important for children to have. And watching this episode really talk about the idea of how important that is beautiful, because it does it in such a way that everybody can resonate with. I don't watch this episode and feel like I'm being preached at about fathers. I feel like I'm just being shown the importance of it, right, by a wonderful story. And that's, I think, where Star Trek, again, does its best job, is when it's not preaching at me, when it just tells a story in a way that can move me to want to be like that, or to have that, or to be better, you know. Again, a testament to Michael Taylor's writing, that I think, whether or not he necessarily, and I don't know how you couldn't, but it does seem like this was something that he really wanted to talk about. And I'm so thankful that he did, because, again, it's just as important now as it was then, and it probably will still be, you know, 50 years from now.
Yeah, oh, it's more important now, because you have more, I mean, more and more the culture is having this sort of redefinition of family. I'm not talking about sexuality. I'm talking about husbands of men and women having children and not being married. In fact, I think we may be at the turning point in history where we're having more, you know, children out of wedlock than in wedlock. And although wedlock may not necessarily be the solution for all of our problems, it's certainly, you know, if you don't have both parents in your life, and it's certainly easier to not be in someone's life when you're not there physically, right? I mean, the parent who's at home when that kid comes home sick from school has to deal with that problem. The parent who is either away on a trip, or away because they're divorced, or away because they're just not a part of that kid's life, they don't have to deal with that in that moment. And so, you know, and then if you're sick, you still have to deal with it. I mean, it's not easy being a single parent. This show really deals with that without, as Matt said, preaching at you about it. But it does speak very much for the importance of parents being there for their children in whatever format that's going to be in the future. But certainly as we redefine family now, and we sort of say, well, this is okay, this is acceptable, we're going to have this, or we're going to have more of this, we have to be aware that a kid still needs those influences, the influences of seeing two people love one another, or at least get an influence of this is in our society, in our culture, this is the ideal way a man should behave. This is the ideal way a woman should behave. I think, for example, you know, the best solution for domestic abuse is fathers teaching their sons how to respect people.
Definitely.
And if your kid doesn't have that influence there, it becomes easy for them to be disrespectful to people, to dehumanize people, which is the first step to all these hosts of problems that families have, like domestic abuse. So the father, you know, of course the mother is also, but speaking in terms of this episode, the father is so important, a presence in someone's life. And if it's not there for whatever reasons, death, divorce, you know, never been there, it can become a detriment to that child, and then he needs somebody to fulfill that role, an older brother, somebody. And I think this episode is a great way to remind all of us that, you know, we have that responsibility to young people, and maybe it's not our child, but maybe it's our nephew or our niece, and we can step in and fill that role for them a little bit and try to be that role model that Ben Siskel is.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, let's talk about a final point, and it's also a story about love and obsession. And what gets me at the end of the episode is when Benjamin tells Jake to let go because he sees what has become of his son, because Jake was never able to let go of the loss of his father. Now, it's a kind of a unique situation. Of course, like, you know, in my case, and John, in your case, you know, our fathers are gone and they're not coming back. There's no connection. We're not tugging them through time because they're out of phase. You know, they're not coming back. But in Jake's situation, it's a little bit unique that he knows that his father is still alive somehow, but he can't do anything about it. And he can't let go. And so his whole life, you know, he gives up his career as a writer and he goes and he studies subspace mechanics and he just devotes his entire life to trying somehow to bring his father back, and even loses his wife because of it. And he becomes a very sad person. And then his whole life is gone. And Benjamin sees this and he's just telling Jake to let go. You know, you still have time to do something. There's a line between honoring the memory of someone or some event and being unable to let go of it and letting it completely control your life in a detrimental way. And I would say, I don't know if Jake went to the extreme of this in letting this event ruin his life, because he certainly had a purpose in his life, but that purpose was trying to undo what had happened in the engine room of the Defiant. What are your thoughts on how Jake reacted to the loss of his father?
Well, I think we could put that in sort of real terms, in the sense of maybe a son whose father goes through something. You know, maybe the father loses their health, loses their ability to walk, loses, you know, maybe their purpose or function. A father who loses their job and can't find another one, or is old enough that the culture basically says, you know, you're not useful anymore in the economy, and it becomes difficult for them to be a provider, you know, to their family anymore. And then to sort of see that, to see the father change, and then the son having the change in reaction to that, you know. And I think that that is one of those truths that this episode speaks to, is the idea of, you know, the father, you know, the you know, a lot of parents will say something and they mean it, but that, you know, we do it every day. Parents do it every day. We'll always say something like, well, I'll sacrifice myself for my child. But normally you don't have to do something that extreme, but we sacrifice in many other ways, not our lives, but, you know, time, money, energy, because they're your child, and it's not a sacrifice. You don't think of it that way. And so I think that that's that moment that Sisko is saying, you know, I don't want you to, you're not supposed to sacrifice for me, right? I want to sacrifice for you. You need to let me go. You know, and these little moments that I have, maybe that's enough. I can deal with it, because no time is passing for me, you know? And I think that that's a beautiful moment where the father is saying, the son is surpassing the father because he's sacrificing himself. And the father wants to sacrifice himself, but can't. There's no way, you know, Sisko can't cut the cord so that Jake lives, old Jake lives. But he would, and you know he would do that. And I think that's a beautiful moment that speaks to that idea of sacrifice of parents and children. And then I think eventually, you know, children do sacrifice for their parents when they take care of them, when they become old and infirmed. More and more a problem in our culture is the, you know, being a sandwich generation where your parents need your help, but your kids need your help. And, you know, the other generations didn't have that because your parents didn't live that long. And so I think this episode, it keeps giving us these kinds of lessons and ideas. And that scene is one of them, I think. That's how I interpret it.
I also see that that idea, Sisko remembers what happened when he lost Jennifer and when he got stuck somewhere and what it did to his life. And I think that he's seeing that in Jake happen, you know, that he's lost in time to the past and he's not seeing his future. And how happy, you know, Benjamin was when Jake had gotten married, he was writing, he was being successful, and, you know, the disappointment that, you know, like you said, John, Ben is feeling this disappointment that he's causing his son to not live. You know, Benjamin tells Jake, you know, you have to look up once in a while. It's life, Jake. You'll miss it if you're not paying attention. And that's exactly what's happening to Jake in this episode as he's pursuing this obsession of getting his father back. He's missing life all around him. And he does end up saving his father. So this is a very unique position. But it really reminds us that we can get caught in those cycles where we kind of live in the past and we live for something that's never going to happen. We get stuck in pursuing that obsessively. And it destroys the life all around us, you know, and it ruins marriages, it ruins friendships, it ruins relationships between sons and fathers and daughters and, you know, all these people, because that actually happens to us. And so it's just a wonderful way of talking about that and being able to think about that. Is there some way that I'm stuck in the past because I haven't let go of something that I really should let go of, even though it's painful?
Yeah, there are two things I was thinking about. One is that's, you know, that's also the theme of Star Wars, right? That's why Anakin goes down, you know, Anakin and Luke have very much the same choices in life, but the difference is that Anakin doesn't accept change and wants to keep things the same way. And where Luke embraces in a way change and understands change occurs, and that allows him to not become mired in the past, mired in his own experiences, but rather be focused on the needs of other people. And I was also thinking about how this episode really does connect with that first episode. What Matt said, I think, is really important, which is that idea of Jennifer, because I mean that's the brilliance of that first of the pilot, right? Is that Sisko is, you know, he is like the prophets because he isn't living the way you're supposed to live. He is nonlinear because he's living in the moment now, actually, but he can't get past his past. And so he's trapped in the past. He is living in two time dimensions, and not doing either successfully when we first meet him. And this episode sort of carries that theme along a little more subtly. But that idea is definitely there about, you know, not letting the past, you know, it's okay to be nostalgic, but you don't want to live, you know, in the past.
Hmm.
Definitely. Well, I think we've covered all the key points of the episode. It was really an interesting discussion, and I'm glad we got to really dig into the relationships that are portrayed in this episode. And every time I watch this episode, I am surprised at how much it affects me. As I mentioned early on in our discussion, it affects me in different ways as I move through life because I pass through all these different stages that Jake passes through. And yet it's just as powerful, if not more powerful, now than it was to me in the past. So wonderful episode. I'm glad we were able to dig into it. John, do you have any final thoughts on The Visitor?
No, I just think it's a great, you know, it's a great episode to talk about around Father's Day. You know, I think it's a great, you know, sometimes people will say, what's a good episode? I want to start someone on Star Trek. And we tend to maybe think of something like Trouble with Tribbles or Lock Time or something like that. But I think this is a beautiful episode that somebody who doesn't know anything about Star Trek, as my students didn't when I showed it to them a long time ago, it's a great episode to start someone off in the world of Star Trek because it gives you everything that is great about Star Trek: ideas, morals, characters that you care about, heroes, people to admire, and an interesting science fiction premise at that. So it's to me, it's really the perfect episode. And I, you know, if someone hasn't seen it, I would say it's great because you could watch it without ever having seen anything else. But of course, having that experience of the other episodes makes it a more richer experience, but it's so good that I was thinking today, this should have been a movie. You know, this should have been Star Trek Deep Space Nine Into Darkness, you know, their version.
It would have been a good movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think that watching this episode tonight and, really just feeling the emotions that it brings up, and, you know, this time watching it, the emotions that I was feeling were different than the last time that I watched it. And I think that that's the power of good writing. It's why we reread stories. Right now I'm on an epic Harry Potter reread and getting different things out of it now that I'm rereading it and than I have before. All because that's what happens when you write a good story. And so I'm just really thankful that this exists in Star Trek. I can't really think of a more impactful episode. You know, on a whole, I don't know if I can even rate this episode because it would just be rated perfect.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I don't really need to give it a rating because obviously it's one of the greatest Star Trek episodes and one of the great sci-fi stories. So, yeah. Well, John, before we let you go, is there anything that you're working on? Anything you want to tell everyone about? You know, you're continuing to do these fantastic sessions where you're talking about The Wrath of Khan, Nicholas Meyer. Anything else coming up?
Yeah, actually, June 25th, to take a totally different turn, I'm giving a presentation with my wife at the Cook Memorial Library in Libertyville, Illinois, about the history of the Lone Ranger. And there's going to be a little bit of Star Trek in there because DeForest Kelly was in several episodes of the Lone Ranger. In fact, he was in the first like regular episode. There was a three-part intro, and then he was in the first regular episode. And then on July 6th at the Lansing Library in Lansing, Illinois, I'm going to be giving a talk on the history of Star Trek collectibles and kind of go through the kind of fun presentation with a lot of trivia a lot of neat, just sort of pictures and rare items and things like that. So that's, both of those are free talks. So if you just visit those websites or if people want to get in contact with me, it's just at J. Tenuto on Twitter, then I can give them information.
Excellent. I wish I were in the States so I could come to one of those.
John, we need to get you down here to Texas to do a few of those.
You can take him to the state fair for that deep fried goth.
There you go. That's right. Take you to the state fair, let you have some really good fried foods, that kind of thing.
I was going to say, you guys, the Texas Rangers are down there for real. So,
yeah, so there you go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, John, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate you taking some time out for us.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for inviting me.
Have a good night.
Well, Matthew, let's tell everyone where to find us if they'd like to share their thoughts on The Visitor. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that will come to us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can easily do that now. Look on any page on the Trek FM website. Look off to the right, and you'll see a tab that says Send Voicemail, and a box will pop up. You can record using your camera mic, and it'll actually submit that to us as an MP3 file. It will upload it for you. You can also go to our forums at trek.fm/forums. There's a section there for the Orb. There's one for DS9. You'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and of course on Twitter under username trekfm. And Matthew, what if people would like to find you personally?
Well, yes, if you would like to find me, you can check me out on MattRushing02 on the Twitter. That's really the easiest place to find me, and talking all sorts of things. So if you follow me, let me know. Give me an at reply and let me know you're following me. We can have a good conversation about Deep Space Nine and Star Trek and all sorts of other things. Plenty of great things to talk about this summer, as well as doing literary treks with you, Chris, on the network, talking about the comics, talking about the books, talking about all those things. Fantastic. Have such a good time doing that. So if you really like the literary universe of Star Trek, which we didn't mention on the show, but in the book series, the 8th season, Jake actually marries the woman that he is married to in the alternate timeline in this episode. So that's really interesting. They actually use that as he still finds that woman in the prime timeline. So great there. Now, Chris, if we want to find you, you're not caught in some sort of spatial phasing in and out, where would we might look for you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. That's the best place. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much everywhere else in social media under that username as well. You can also find me at my personal website, which finally I have finished revamping it. It is online once again. That's cbrianjones.com. Very easy to find there. You can check out my writing on general science fiction, technology, music, check out photos, all kinds of stuff up there. And of course, you can find me also on Trek FM every week on The Ready Room, where, Matthew, you are with me very often. We just had our 100th episode this week, and we got together, 10 of us from across the network, for a gigantic discussion about 100 things we love about Star Trek. And I'll tell you, it was a blast. It was a monster to edit, but I hope everyone enjoys that. And also, while we're talking about places to find us, if you like The Orb, if you like our other shows on the network, head over to iTunes. It only takes about 30 seconds. You can go over there and leave us a star rating, leave us a written review. We'd love to hear from you, and that helps other people find the show. And we really appreciate everyone who has already done that for us. And lastly, Matthew, let's tell everyone about our sponsor for today's show. We would really love for you all to go check out TrekFan.org. TrekFan is this really cool concept. It's not just a fan club, it's a challenge. You get together with other fans, you'll explore new places, you'll learn new things, and you'll collaborate with those fans to solve puzzles and complete real-life mission objectives, and you'll win great prizes. If you go over to the website, you'll face your first challenge. Go to trekfan.org, see if you can figure out that challenge and take the next step towards what's one of the most interesting things that we've seen put together for fans.
Well, thank you everyone for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.